Gaul is a whole divided into three parts, one of which is inhabited by the Belgae, another by the Aquitani, and a third by a people called in their own tongue Celtae, in the Latin Galli. All these are different from one another in language, institutions, and laws. The Galli are separated from the Aquitani by the river Garonne, from the Belgae by the Marne and the Seine. Of all these peoples, the Belgae are the most courageous, because they are the farthest removed from the culture and civilization of the province, and least often visited by merchants introducing the commodities that make for effeminacy, and also because they are nearest to the Germans dwelling beyond the Rhine, with whom they are continually at war. For this cause, the Helvetii also excel the rest of the Gauls in valour, either endeavouring to keep them out of Gallic territory or waging aggressive warfare in German territory. The separate part of the country, which, as has been said, is occupied by the Gauls, starts from the river Rhone and is bounded by the river Garonne, the ocean, and the territory of the Belgae. Moreover, on the side of the Sequani and the Helvetii, it touches on the river Rhine, and its general trend is northward. The Belgae, beginning from the edge of the Gallic territory, reach to the lower part of the river Rhine, bearing towards the north and east. Aquitania, starting from the Garonne, reaches to the Pyrenees and to that part of the ocean which is by Spain. Its bearing is between west and north. Since I have arrived at this point, it would seem to be not inappropriate to set forth the customs of Gaul and of Germany, and the difference between these nations. In Gaul, not only in every state and every canton and district, but almost in every several household, there are parties, and the leaders of the parties are men who, in the judgments of their fellows, are deemed to have the highest authority, men to whose decision and judgment the supreme issue of all cases and councils may be referred. And this seems to have been an ordinance from ancient days, to the end that no man of the people should lack assistance against a more powerful neighbour, for each man refuses to allow his own folk to be oppressed and defrauded, since otherwise he has no authority among them. The same principle holds in regard to Gaul, as a whole, taken together, for the whole body of states is divided into two parties. Among the gods, they most worship Mercury. There are numerous images of him. They declare him the inventor of all arts, the guide for every road and journey, and they deem him to have the greatest influence for all money-making and traffic. After him, they set Apollo, Mars, Jupiter, and Minerva. Of these deities, they have almost the same idea as all other nations. Apollo drives away diseases, Minerva supplies the first principles of arts and crafts, Jupiter holds the empire of heaven, Mars controls wars. To Mars, when they have determined on a decisive battle, they dedicate as a rule whatever spoil that they take. After a victory, they sacrifice such living things as they have taken, and all the other effects they gather into one place. In many states, heaps of such objects are to be seen piled up in hallowed spots, and it has, and often happened, that a man, in defiance of religious scruple, has dared to conceal such spoils in his house, or to remove them from their place, and the most grievous punishment with torture is ordained for such an offence. The Gauls affirm that they are all descended from a common father, Dis, and say that this is the tradition of the Druids. For that reason, they determine all periods of time by the number, not of days, but of nights. And in their observance of birthdays and the beginning of months and years, day follows night. In the other ordinances of life, the main difference between them and the rest of mankind is that they do not allow their own sons to approach them openly until they have grown to an age where they can bear the burden of military service, and they count it a disgrace for a son who is still in his boy to take his place publicly in the presence of his father. The men, after making a due reckoning, take from their own goods a sum of money equal to the dowry that they have received from their wives, and place it with the dowry. Of each sum, a count is kept between them and the profits saved. Whichever of the two survives receives the portion of both together with the profits of past years. Men have the power of life and death over their wives as over their children, and when the father of a house, who is of distinguished birth, has died, his relatives assemble, and if there be anything suspicious about his death, they make inquisition of his wives as they would of slaves, and if discovery is made, they put them to death with fire and all manner of excruciating tortures. Their funerals, considering the civilization of Gaul, are magnificent and expensive. They cast into the fire everything, even living creatures which they believe to have been dear to the departed during life. And but a short time before the present age, only a generation since, slaves and dependents known to have been beloved by their lords used to be burnt with them at the conclusion of the funeral formalities. Those states which are supposed to conduct their public administration to greater advantage have it prescribed by law that anyone who has learnt anything of public concern from his neighbours, by rumour or report, must bring the information to a magistrate, and not impart it to anyone else, for it is recognised that oftentimes hasty and inexperienced men are terrified by false rumours, and so are driven to crime or to decide supreme issues. Magistrates conceal what they choose and make known what they think proper for the public. Speech on state questions, except by means of an assembly, is not allowed. Among the Helvetii, the noblest man by far and the most wealthy was Orgetorix. In the consulship of Marcus Messala and Marcus Piso, his desire for the kingship led him to form a conspiracy of the nobility, and he persuaded the community to march out of their territory in full force, urging that as they excelled all in valour, it was easy enough to secure the sovereignty of all Gaul. In this he persuaded them the more easily, because the Helvetii are closely confined by the nature of their territory. On one side, there is the River Rhine, exceeding broad and deep, which separates the Helvetian territory from the Germans, and on another, the Jura Range, exceeding high, lying between Sequani and the Helvetii. On the third, the Lake of Geneva and the River Rhone, which separates the Roman province from the Helvetii. In such circumstances, their range of movement was less extensive, and on this account, they were greatly distressed, for they were men that longed for war. Nay, they could not but consider that the territory that they occupied, to an extent of 240 miles long and 180 broad, was all too narrow for their population and for their renown of courage in war. Swayed by these considerations and stirred by the influence of Orgetorix, they determined to collect what they needed for taking the field, to buy up as large a number as they could of draft cattle and carts, to sow as much corn as possible so as to have a sufficient supply thereof on the march, and to establish peace and amity with the nearest communities. For the accomplishment of these objects, they considered that 2 years were sufficient, and pledged themselves by an ordinance to take the field in the third year. When Caesar was informed that they were endeavouring to march through the Roman province, he made speed to leave Rome, and hastening to further Gaul by as rapid stages as possible, arrived near Geneva. From the whole province he requisitioned the largest possible number of troops, there was in further Gaul no more than a single legion, and ordered the bridge at Geneva to be broken down. When the Helvetii learned of his coming, they sent as deputies to him the noblest men of their state. Nemeus and Veracloetius held the chief palace in the deputation, with instructions to say that their purpose was to march through the province without any mischief, because they had no other route, and they asked that they might have to leave so to do of his good will. Remembering that the consul Lucius Cassus had been slain, and his army routed and sent under the yoke by the Helvetii, Caesar considered that no concession should be made. Nor did he believe that men of unfriendly disposition, if granted the opportunity of marching through the province, would refrain from outrage and mischief.